I think we should all wear fedoras when we go to YouTube. I've got two, so I'm
ready. I'll go get my fedora right now. I got one in the other room.
I got one downstairs, yeah.
Good. Why don't you go get it? I'll go get mine.
All right, let's do it. Yeah, let's go to YouTube. Go get it.
Back to the bin.
I feel like that guy in the opening of The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Klaatu?
No, the guy who's on.
I think you live for that. No, Rennie.
Michael Rennie.
His last name is Michael Rennie.
I love that movie. Love that movie.
And it holds up. It's a great movie.
Yes, it does. Yeah. I watched it with Logan not long ago, thinking that he'd probably be bored stiff by it, but he enjoyed it too.
It's a fantastic story too. That's
It holds up. It holds up well. What was funny is we watched. What the hell was it with the other night? Something came up in conversation. Maybe it was The Sound of Music. And I mentioned to Logan that it was directed by Robert Wise. He's like, should I know that name? He goes, that name sounds familiar. I said, he did Star Trek The Motion Picture and The Day the Earth Stood Still. And he goes, he did The Sound of Music. He's like, I said, remember we watched The Haunting not long ago? And he goes, he did that. It's like those films have nothing to do with one another. I was like, exactly. The guy was very talented to do such a wide range of movies.
I would have loved to have seen Gore kick the shit out of what's the name and The Sound of Music. That movie would have been great. Then.
It's my wife's favorite movie. I've suffered through it once or twice, but yeah, it's not my jam.
I had actually never seen it, and then last year I watched it with Tina. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's all right. It's not my thing, but on a technical level.
When we were kids, the church did The Sound of Music, and my sister and the two girls next door tried out for it. All summer I had to listen to it over and over and over and over.
That's funny.
And I always think of, with Edelweiss, I always think of Superman, because didn't he have to go and get Edelweiss for the wedding that time in The Adventures of Superman?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
I've been very slowly making my way through that. I mean, I'm enjoying it, but I'm not like burning them back to back or anything. But I watched one the other night. What the hell was it? It was like the fifth episode, I think, on disc one, season one, and it was good. I really liked it, but I can't even remember what the hell the name of it was now, but it was a good episode.
We need to cover the pilot.
So you say that, and I watched the pilot, and I don't know what, maybe it's the way the thing is, because I'm watching them on the DVD, when they release.
Yeah, that's what I got.
That moment's not in the pilot that we're both remembering, where he strands the people up. Because
the pilot. That's in The Stolen Costume is the name of the episode.
Okay. All right. That must be why. But that's weird, because I've seen that, and I haven't seen a lot of The Adventures of Superman that I remember. So I know I'd seen it.
All of them.
You do remember all of them?
I think so. I've seen them so many times.
Yeah, so I've been, very slow, because I just, not long ago, I bought all five seasons off of Mercari for, dirt cheap, and I've been slowly making my way through. But I tell you what I have been burning through is a $6 Million Man.
I started that.
It's just a fun show.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I loved it when I was a kid, but it's one of those where... I only have vague. I didn't have any specific memories of it. So I've been rewatching it, and I'm like, damn, does this show? I mean, it really holds up. And part of it for me is the appeal of I always thought the astronaut thing was kind of an offhand, like, oh, he was an astronaut and they did, you know, Beyond the Pilot didn't really make a big deal. And it, no, that's like a thing through the whole series so far is, you know, he'll go, you know, on adventures and people will be like, oh, I remember seeing you walk on the moon. It's just cool that it continues to carry through. I like that.
I'm only in season one. And you know what bothers me? They haven't added the sound effects yet.
That takes time. Yeah. I'm like, wow,
I thought this was out of the gate.
Nope. No, I'm in season three right now and just watched the very first episode that had the sound effect. You know where he'll like club somebody bionically and it'll go like, blah, 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 blah. That sound effect just got added in season three. So, yeah, it's slow.
You know what else was like slow? The running in slow motion isn't in the beginning either.
Right. Yeah. There's several of them where he actually runs at like, you know, they show it like super speed. But the problem is that it looks funny, you know.
Well, be honest. Don't you hear in your mind the Benny Hill music?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. But I wish that there was a way for them to like George Lucas them a little bit, you know. Because that's my only issue with it is, yes, I'm very much enjoying it, but you really have to be in a mood to want to watch them because, you know, they're you know, by today's standards are very slow, most of them. Some of them are a little more action-y than others, but most of them, even if they've got a lot of bionic stuff going on, the bionic stuff is all in friggin' slow motion, so it doesn't seem very exciting sometimes. It's weird like that.
You know what? I guess I misremembered. I always had this memory that him and Oscar were like just buddies out of the gate. And like, they're kind of not at the beginning.
It gets there, though. I mean, they eventually get to a point where they're like double dating, and which is just fucking weird because, you know, Oscar's his boss and stuff.
Did you get to the point of seeing Oscar Goldman on, what's it called, The Night Strangler?
That's the only thing I have left. I finished the whole series. I'm waiting to watch that.
You need to watch The Night Strangler.
So he was on there with Davin McGarren?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
the
fun.
Second TV movie.
I'm so disappointed that they, you know, I'm done with it.
It's not really much of a spoiler. Not really much of a spoiler, but he's the bad guy in the second.
Oh, wow.
Huh. Well, you know who's the bad guy in one of those Night Stalkers is Dr. Hostline.
Oh, is that right?
He's a werewolf.
That's funny.
Oh, that's cool.
And he's also in like the second episode of the $6 Million Man.
Well, I'm struck by just how many Star Trek people are, you know, just how many connections there are between Star Trek and $6 Million Man. I never knew.
Well, were they on the same network?
No, I don't think so. I'm pretty sure Star Trek was CBS. Yeah, and I'm pretty sure the $6 Million Man was ABC.
I guess people just made the rounds.
Yeah.
I noticed Larry Storch's and everything. Actors.
There's been at least two different episodes now playing two different characters with the guy that was Galt from Gamesters of Triskelion, the head thrall.
Okay.
Ball-headed dude with the robe, kind of like a Dracula type of thing.
I don't know if you would recognize him in regular clothing.
Yeah, oh, you will. He's very distinctive looking when you see him.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, like Shatner's in it. Oh my God, is he over the top in his episode? George Takei, and then just a ton of like people that, you know, were in Star Trek for like an episode or something, you know, played like, you know, a villain or, you know, somebody they met on a planet or something like that. Just tons and tons of Star Trek people in it. But yeah, I've been enjoying the hell out of it, except the most recent episode I watched, he teamed up with Sonny Bono, and that one was fucking painful to get through. Because he just kept singing. He's playing like this big, you know, like a big rock star. But he just keeps singing the same song. And it's like four different sequences of him on stage. But every time they do it, it's the same song. And you're like, has this guy not got any other songs in his repertoire? Because this is getting really old. But
see, now you never watched Lois and Clark, right?
No.
There's one episode where he plays the mayor of Metropolis.
Oh, God.
He doesn't sing, but he's actually really funny. Because he's like having a press conference, and the answer to every question is like a song from his Sonny and Cher days. You know, like, next question. I got you, babe. The heat goes on. You know, stuff like that. He's just funny.
I can't decide if I should ever go back and give that show another chance or not, because I wanted to love that show when it aired, and I just fucking hated it. I just couldn't hang with it. I watched like the first, I don't know, four or six episodes, and I just put me off so much. But
you know what we're gonna do? We're gonna do a commentary on the H.G. Wells one, where they ask how dumb Lois Lane is. It'll either be great, or I'll be like, oh, this is terrible. I'm not remembering this right at all.
I don't know. One of these, when I get through, you know, like the Superman one, you know, the Adventures of Superman, get through $6 Million Man. I mean, I want to branch out and do some others. So I might give that a second chance. I also, one of these days, I really had wanted to go back and watch through Superboy. Because I made the effort to track those down some time ago, and I think I have the whole series, but I've only ever watched just a handful of those too. But that one's like all over the place quality wise. Did you watch that Superboy?
You know, it's funny, I didn't. Yeah. And I don't have access to it. I want to get through like you, the Adventures of Superman first.
Yeah.
I've been enjoying the hell out of Babylon 5, though, I'll tell you that much.
Really?
Yeah.
What'd you say, Paul?
When you're ready, then when you're ready, maybe we'll do a commentary on one or two Adventures of Superman episodes. You could pick out
the two
that way I could remind the people once again that that's my Superman.
I tell you, though.
Mine as well.
I wish I had either watch the series first and then the what's the name of that movie? Hollywoodland. Never watched Hollywoodland altogether. Have you seen it?
I have not.
Yes.
I would say
not. Don't watch it.
Don't watch it. Not that it's not a good movie. It's a very well put together movie. It is entertaining, but it's one of those, like, did you ever read Marvel, The Untold Story?
Yes.
Did it kind of just break your heart?
A little bit, yeah.
It's very much like that. It's one of these where, like, you're entertained while you're, you know, watching or reading or whatever, but then you get to the end and, like, God damn it, I wish I just didn't know how the sausage was made, you know? And that's exactly how I felt at the end of that movie. I'm like, if there's any... Now, I realize it's, what do you call it? It's Hollywood eyes because it's a movie. So, you know, there's some question on whether it's completely like, is this real or, you know, did they, you know, spruce it up or whatever? But there's supposed to be enough truth in it that, you know, it's more or less representational of the truth. And if it is true, it just breaks my heart. It's like, I just don't want to know that this guy that I looked up to, that I still think was a hell of a good Superman, that he, you know, he was just a sorry human being and really fucking hated his life and being in that. And I'm like, I don't want to know that, you know, I just
I don't want to know that either.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, you got a good point. Sometimes you're better off just with the character they play and
right, not
the real person. And I find that a lot. All right, so let's talk comic books, and because otherwise I'm just going to get angry again.
All right, I'm getting hot.
You won't like me when I'm angry.
That's what I hear.
Are we keeping hats on or are we taking hats off?
I'm going to leave mine on.
All right,
you can leave
I
these.
Love
you
hats.
See, I over here in my recording studio now, I have the Maltese Falcon.
Oh, that's
stuff
awesome.
Dreams are made of.
Where did you get that?
That was my friend Paul Smith, who he posts on our stuff, but you may have met him I specifically introduced him to Scott at the wedding. His mom passed away, and she had that. Aww. And he said, I think you would like to have this. And so he gave it to me. The funny thing is, I could have played Monty Python and the Holy Grail with him, and I could have said, I already got one, because I have
Maltese Falcon downstairs. Very nice.
I told him we already got one.
We went to see that recently. There was a community theater put it on. It was pretty good, actually. I used to work with the guy who played Humphrey Bogart part. Sam Spade.
I always forget if it's Sam Spade or Philip Marlowe. I get the two mixed up.
No, Sam Spade. Philip Marlowe is Marlowe.
Okay, so hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I am Rom, and I'm here with Stankery and Commissioner Do Nothing Gordon.
Hello.
Playing the part of Stankery today is Mr. Scott Gardner.
Hello.
And playing the part of Commissioner Do Nothing Gordon is Mr. David Pascarella.
Oh, you just handle it. I like to watch work.
Yeah, we will be addressing that in this episode. So today we decided we're just going with two random books. We were going to go with three, but then when Scott picked his third book, it expanded into like 16 books. So we said, you know what, we'll do that as a separate episode.
It's going to be a sub-series within the series.
I wanted to joke around and say Scott's a lazy so-and-so and didn't pick a book, but it really is just the opposite. Scott picked a million books. Can we do all of these tonight?
No, I picked one book, and then I thought, well, this would be interesting to do a compare and contrast with another book that's very similar to it. That's all. Just two books.
Yeah, we'll see. See how that works out.
Maybe three.
How many in the series? 16.
Well, all right, I'll let the cat out of the bag. We'll tease it for another time. But so the book I was going to bring next episode was it won't necessarily be next episode, but it will be in the near future. The book I was going to bring was $6 Million Man number one by Charlton back in sometime in the 70s. I forget the year on the book. From the comic series, which ran 8 or 9 issues. I don't know. I could look it up real quick. But having recently read it, so I'm on a kick right now with the $6 million man. I'm rewatching the show, and I got to thinking, hey, I should be checking out the comic, you know, that was more or less concurrent as well. So I've been reading the comic. Well, there was also, along with the comic, there was a magazine that, Charlton put out, much like Marvel did magazines back in the 70s. And the first issue of the magazine also covers, at least in the first part of the story, the origin of the $6 million man, just like the first issue of the comic did. But they're slightly different. And then once you get past the origin, which is more or less like the TV pilot, the first mission he goes on in each of those stories is completely different. So I thought it'd be fun. Plus the, I'm not sure about the writer, but I know that the art team is different in each book, because in the comic it's Joe Staton, and in the magazine, I believe it's Neil Adams, or at least that Adams had a hand in it. So it's different art teams, and you know, so I thought it'd be fun to do like a compare and contrast. The reason I say maybe three is I got to thinking, I know that there was also $6 million man Power Records, and I think at least one of them had like the book and record type of deal going with it. So the origin may have been covered in that. So I've got to research this. I'll get back to you. So if it's covered in that too,
there was also a more recent series of the $6 million man. And by recent, I mean, say within the last 10 to 15 years, not that recent.
If you're talking the Dynamite, was it Dynamite? I think it was Dynamite, either Dynamite or Boom. Dynamite, I think. Yeah, I think way back in Bin's history, Andy Leyland and I covered the first, I don't know, several episodes or issues of that, like the first three or six or something like that. We always meant to go back and expand on it and then just never did get around to it. But yeah, at some point I could not even guess at what episode numbers that would be. But yeah, we did cover that. Spoiler, I loved that series, at least when it started. Because if memory serves, that was a the series was based on a script that Kevin Smith had written for a $6 million man movie that just never got made. So they made it into a comic. It was damn good. At least starting out, it was really, really good. Very well done. Unfortunately, it ran out of gas pretty quick. I don't think it went beyond 24 issues, maybe at the most, something like that. But at least in, you know, in the very beginning of the title, it was good.
Yeah, there's also a Dynamite G.I. Joe versus the $6 Million Man.
Yeah.
2018, which was fun.
It was fun. Yeah, I read that. Yeah. I think with the exception of they did a season 6 comic book series, Dynamite did, of the $6 Million Man. I have not read that yet because I just didn't remember the series well enough. So I didn't want to go into it not being up to speed. So I'm on a rewatch. And once I finish my rewatch of the series, then I'll read that, that comic series. But yeah, so far, you know, to varying degrees, I've enjoyed everything that, that Dynamite put out for the $6 Million Man.
Have you listened to any of the Power records? I'm just curious.
Not since I was a kid. And I know I haven't ever listened to them all. But
I have this fear that, you know, the guy who played Batman will be the voice of
here. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think if memory serves, the guy that they get does sound at least passably like Lee Majors, I think. But yeah, I mean, I haven't listened to one of those in, you know, literally decades. So I really don't remember that well. But anyway, there's a little teaser, something for the listeners to look forward to, or not.
Okay. But in the meanwhile, Dave and I picked random books. And I guess, is mine older than yours, Dave, or is yours older?
I think mine is older. Mine is from the year of our Lord, 1976. How appropriate, yeah, 50 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yours is older. So, up to you. You want to go first or second?
I'm happy to go first.
I'm happy to let you go first.
Let me get out my paper notes, because that's how I roll.
Wow.
Real paper, folks.
Yeah. I'm going to be going truly old school, because, you know, we've been listening to Classic Bins lately, and clearly there was no pre-written synopsis. Everybody just kind of, Scott I always forget the co-host's name. They just kind of talked off the top of their head. Yeah, this is what this book was about.
Then the rules, so, you know.
That's where I'm going today. That was before the show got rigid. So go ahead, Dave.
Now it's an establishment show. We have precise format. All right, folks. I'm bringing to the table the next book in my reading project. Detective Comics number 462, cover dated August of 1976, on sale May 27th of 76. I was about, let's see, I'm not even 5 years old yet. This would have cost you...
Little Dave.
Say again?
I said
Little Dave. This would have cost you a whopping 30 cents, 3 dimes back then. This was written by Bob Rozakis and Michael Uslan, according to Mike's Amazing World. Penciler is Ernie Chan, inker Frank McLaughlin, and edited by Julie Schwartz. The cover art is by Ernie Chan. And the title of this issue, Kill Batman in Triplicate. Now, this is the second part of a two-part story, but don't worry, you'll be able to figure this out relatively easy. On the cover of the book, we see Batman wielding a sword, and frozen in a block of ice up to the waist. As ice crystals form on the rest of Batman's body, the villainous Captain Stingery slashes with his sword at the block of ice containing Batman's lower extremities. In the background, two other Batman are chained. This story continues from the last issue. On our opening splash page, Captain Stingery confronts three imprisoned Batmen. One is tied to a chair, one is chained to a slab, and one is half frozen in a block of ice, a la the cover of the book. Captain Stingery vows that tonight, all three Batmen will die. Captain Stingery believes that there are secretly three Batmen, all brothers. He has already captured two. Cutting away, Robin, responding to an anonymous tip regarding the location of a drug-dealing ring's headquarters near Hudson University, heads through the snow to a cabin. Even though Robin is suspicious, he needs to check it out. Whether it was an accident or planned, as Robin approaches, he is buried in a sudden avalanche of snow, which pretty much just looks like the snow off the roof fell onto him. But I digress. Early the next morning, Batman gets a summons from Commissioner Gordon to get to police headquarters because someone has left a block of ice right outside. And in that block is embedded Robin. As Batman arrives, he finds not a policeman in sight, but three criminals who are attempting to steal the block of ice so they can use it to blackmail Batman into laying off. Only after Batman defeats them does Gordon and his men appear. Gordon comments that he held back because he likes to watch Batman in action. Go, Gordon.
Whoa! Dude, that's creepy.
Gordon also points out that the weather is 50 degrees and the ice block isn't melting. Concerned that it might be a booby trap, Batman takes the ice back to the Batcave. There he uses a blowtorch on it, but suddenly discovers that the heat is causing the ice block, as well as the entire cave, to grow colder. Realizing this is a trap, Batman calls for Jerome to come in, because we all know who Jerome is, right? As the door opens, a second Batman appears. Batman's plan is to trap the captain by switching places with Jerome Courtney, who is dressed as the Batman. Jerome is one of three triplets, all of whom have recently masqueraded as Batman. In his first battle with the captain, the real Batman secretly used nose filters to escape a canister of ether that knocked down the captain temporarily. Batman used that time to locate Michael Courtney and persuade him to switch places. 24 hours later, Batman again succeeded in KOing his foe and made another timely substitute with Robert Courtney. Jerome Courtney finishes the work Batman began and is quickly frozen in a block of ice. Stingery appears at the Batcave, having placed a tracer inside Robin's block of ice, and takes the frozen Batman back to his headquarters. He unmasks him and prepares to kill all three Batmen, when suddenly three more Batmen show up. The captain and Batman fight, while the other Batmen... Sorry, technical issue. Vanish. Batman taunts him to summon his crew, only to find out the captain is working alone. Batman did not capture Stingery earlier because he wanted his entire crew. Robin and the Flash appear. They were ready to join the fight if necessary. Flash reveals that he moved Batman at super speed, making it look like there were three Batmen earlier. Flash then used his vibration powers on the ice, also revealing that the captain learn the secret of imprisoning ice from an old cellmate, Captain Cold. Afterwards, the Flash leaves. Batman later explains his deductions to the Courtney triplets. Robin and Gordon are there as well. It appears the captain made a few slips when he thought Batman was unconscious, remarking that the Courtney triplets may fool others, but not him. Batman recruited the triplets to play along as they are private investigators. The captain plotted to kill the Batman men and take their place, using the name and prestige to make big money, both legally and illegally. The captain knew about the triplets' work, talents, and their highly successful detective firm. And for him, it was a natural choice that the triplets were the identities of the Batman. Also, there was the vendetta factor. Batman reveals that the triplets are not triplets, but in reality, quadruplets. And the captain is their brother Carl, the black sheep of the family. How was that for 70s fun? I know you're on the edge of your seat. Maybe you want to take a breath.
I want to take your breath for making me read this.
I'm not ready to beat on Dave yet because of it. I thought it was a little batshit crazy, no pun intended.
Yes.
But it was an interesting read.
I picked this because it was the next book in my reading project. And I figured I'd kill two birds with one stone. Perhaps if we were stoned, this would have been a better story.
I feel better now because I was really afraid you're going to be like, I have loved this issue since I was a small child. I think it's great. So, okay.
This is the kind of book that as a child encourage you not to read.
Right. First off, out of the gate, let me just say, you know, tons of respect for Bob Rozakis for two big reasons. For one, he was the answer man, and he still is the answer man, and he's a great guy. I'm Facebook friends with him, and he's still active. He's still a hell of a nice guy, and I have read, you know, other things by him that I really like. The other big thing is, you know, he's one of the co-creators of Amazing Man, which is still, in my opinion, one of the best books of the 1980s. I don't know if you guys ever read that, but it was a fantastic book. So, yeah, I mean, I have tons of respect for Bob Rozakis, but wow, this is not one of his better efforts. I just didn't think it made a hell of a lot of sense. Is it just me? Or
a hell of a lot of sense?
No.
It made no sense.
It made hardly any sense.
Okay, all right, well, good.
It was out there.
I mean, I read this book twice and was still like, I'm just not getting it. I just don't understand what the hell's going on. There's vast leaps in logic. And yeah.
How many IQ points do you feel you lost having read this?
Oh God. Well, you know, I mean, I'm in the middle of Silver Age Superman right now, so I'm not sure how many IQ points I've really got left altogether. So, but yeah. I mean, the other big problem with this is that you've got Captain Stingery is your villain. I'm like, oh, come on. This like guy's a mort of the biggest, you know, with a capital M. And he wouldn't be a fit villain for Aquaman, let alone Batman. I mean, why is he a pirate? He doesn't even need to be a pirate in this story.
Okay, he's the guy the village people could have taken out.
I'm going to give it an off-color joke now.
Uh-oh.
I saw this as a meme, and I just cracked up laughing. There's a guy, he's on a blind date for the first time with this Asian woman. And he says, what do you do for a living? She says, I'm a pirate. He says, oh, a pirate, you go and rob ships? Arrgh. She says, no, I'm a pirate, I fry cranes.
Now you see in those early detective comic issues, that was common.
That's not funny. No, it is. It's actually very funny.
Scott, who are we going to get to replace Paul?
I don't know. He's going to get canceled.
You know what? I know. Cancel me. I'm retired. What do I care?
That's funny. What? Do we ever see this guy again? This
I hope you, there's another appearance at some point because Mikeless, you know, next scene and I don't even want to go there.
Good Lord.
Do you want to cover that one next?
Say, you said, Dave, you said Ernie Chan, but it says Ernie Chua on the page. Is that one and the same person?
Yes.
Okay. I think the artwork here is very inconsistent. Like you have Walking Dead Robin on the second page. I mean, there are some of the facial expressions are terrible in here. Look at on the next page to, you know, Bruce Wayne up in the upper right corner. Look at his face.
Look at his hair.
I think that's some of it. Yeah. Some of it's bad. I'm usually not used to that. I'm usually used to it being better. But some of the action sequences look very well choreographed.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what it is. I'm not sure if it's McLaughlin's inks or what's going on, because generally I really like Chan, Chua, whatever. I'm trying to remember which did he start with and which did he go to? Because he started as one and then changed his name or changed how he was credited. I think one is his actual name, but he started with a different one that he was credited under. But I'm not sure which way
I'm thinking. I'm thinking Chan is probably the made up one, just because that's more common.
Right.
But I don't know for a fact. And then, you know, just with Ernie Chan, I wish Dr. Bill was here so we could have little Ernie Chan and the Chan clan.
Oh, God. We took a lot of. Okay. Yeah. According to Wikipedia, it is Chan, and he was sometimes credited as Chua. I have no idea why. But is he still around? No.
What did you think of the artwork in here?
Me? Yeah. I like it because I like him. I mean, I like Chan's stuff a lot. You're right. In inconsistent's a good way to describe it because it is very inconsistent. Because when you first made the crack about Walking Dead Robin, I'm like, oh, I like Robin in this. But then I actually flip back to the page and I'm like, I can see what you're saying. It is very inconsistent because it's like panels one and three look really good, but then two and the others are they're odd.
The last panel on that page, it wouldn't have shocked me if I saw that panel and they said Frank Miller drew it.
Yeah, I can see that. I don't know. I mean,
I like a lot of Frank Miller. It's not like I'm criticized with it.
Some of the Batman stuff looks really good because some of it reminds me a lot of, now I'm going to blank on his name.
Some of it reminds me of General Power.
Some of it's kind of a parallel, but Novik is who I was thinking of. What was his name? Irv Novik, yeah. And I like the Batmobile. I think the Batmobile looks kind of cool. I like that sporty Batmobile. So, I mean, some of it I like a lot.
Is well done.
Yeah. And then there's others that are just, I don't know, some of it's weird. And I do think the inks are inconsistent. So I'm wondering if maybe it's the inks that are dragging some of it down artistically. But I don't know. It's an odd beast altogether, really, art-wise, story-wise, definitely. I just, if you're going to use such a weird and unusual villain, then use him for a reason. There is absolutely no reason in this story that this guy needs to be a friggin' pirate. Why is he a pirate? I just don't get that at all. Why isn't he just a dude?
Because he fries cranes.
I mean, did I miss something in this? Is there something vital in this story where he has to be a sea-based villain?
because they drew that lovely pirate ship.
It took place in 1976. That's
I guess. It's just ridiculous.
He will be back in
To give him some
Secret Society of Supervillains number 6.
That's okay. I was trying to remember where I knew this guy from because I knew I had seen him before. I could not play. That's what it is, Secret Society. Because I dug that book a lot. I really like Secret Society. So I knew I had seen him before. Does he die?
You'd know better than me. No, he gets the miniseries.
Probably not.
Give them time. He'll be in a series next month after they hear this.
Because I'm looking at I did a quick Google for him, and I don't have time to read the article, but one of the artistic pictures that popped up on doing a Google search, there's one here. I don't know what artist it is. It looks a lot like, what's that artist? I can't think of his name. The one that got famous doing like the girly stuff, Adam Hughes. It looks a lot like Adam Hughes art. So it's modern art with Captain Stingray. So evidently the guy is still around. But
well, I got news for you. He comes back in Batman 294 after that.
Huh. He's in Batman. He's in Detective 4. Is this 410 or 440? I can't read it.
He keeps coming back, Detective 526.
Oh, I see. This what issue is this?
462.
Okay, so this isn't even his first appearance. He first appeared two issues before this. So maybe that issue explained the whole pirate thing. I don't know. I didn't realize this was part of an ongoing thing. So is he also in 461? Was this like a
three? Yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay, so this was like a three-part story. Okay, all right.
It's an epic adventure.
I guess.
I think it's only a two-parter.
Okay.
I think they're full of crap.
Well, thanks, Dave. You spoiled it. Now I know how it ends.
Guess what I'm getting you for Christmas?
Oh, God.
It's going to get you the life-sized Captain Stingray.
Did they do a figure?
Not yet. That's the one they're going to release next month for Superpowers.
Hey, you never know, because you know who I saw a figure of the other day?
Who?
The Hypno Hustler has an action figure. And I'm like, if he can get an action figure, anybody can get an action figure now. And that's actually pretty cool.
Hypno Hustler is famous for being like
the magazine.
The Mort.
Right, yeah.
So, but he actually has a level of fame because of his Mortness.
Right, right.
Captain Stingray is just obscure.
That's true. That is very true. You know what would be really fun is I don't do a lot of toy collecting anymore because I just don't have the room and I don't need another hobby. But that would be a fun hobby to get into is collecting figures of Morts and have like a whole Mort collection. That would be cool. Or not.
Well, you'd have a very niche audience for that if you had people over the house. Like, most people would be like, I have no idea who these characters are and I have no interest. That's
the fun. I think that'd be the fun.
But if you had people like us over, we'd be laughing at it more.
Right.
But honestly, if you got me before Dave gave me this book to read and said, oh, here's the character, you know, the more action figure of Captain Stingray, I'd be saying, who the heck is that? Even though I apparently have read issues with him in there before because I read the whole run of Secret Society of Supervillains. So, right. But I had no memory of him. He certainly didn't make an impression on me.
Well, he's very generic. He's generic pirate villain, you know? There's nothing mm-hmm. distinctive about him.
Other than his purple coat.
I mean, but even that, I mean, he could easily be confused for any of Aquaman's sea-based enemies because Aquaman had a lot of complete, you know, just like this guy, completely forgettable ocean-themed bad guys. Like,
wasn't there somebody similar to this, Scott, when we did that old issue of Strange Tales with the Human Torch and Iceman and they were on the ferry? And
yeah.
And wasn't there a guy not unlike this that
Yeah. Yeah, what was his
Attack
name?
The Fairy.
Yeah, Captain... Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I cannot think of what the guy's name was, though. But I swear, there's an Aquaman villain that I think even looks like this guy, where he has a... like a galleon that travels under the water instead of on the surface of the water, like normal. And he's almost the same kind of thing visually, I think. So, yeah, I mean, I don't, it's weird. I mean, were they running this low on creativity and bad guys and stuff for Batman? And, you know, this, what is this? 76, you said?
76.
They're running a little low on that.
Torch and Iceman fought Barracuda.
Barracuda, that was it. Yeah.
76 is a somewhat painful year so far, because you're waiting to get, you know, like, oh, the Joker or the Penguin or Catwoman. And first you have the Crime Olympics, which takes up several issues, and then you get this guy, and you're like, no wonder this comic almost went under,
right? Yeah,
so I have some questions, if I may. I'm just a little curious. One, as I said before, Robin gets taken out by the snow that slides off the roof, basically. Two, how he doesn't suffocate in a block of ice
is beyond. I wonder that anytime any character ever gets completely encased in ice, that's the first thing I always think of, is why aren't they dead? Why didn't they suffocate? They never address that in these stories.
And go ahead.
You've seen The Incredibles, right?
Yes.
I absolutely love that movie, but it happens in that movie. There's the part where Mr. Incredible and Frozone, in their civilian identities, they are saving people from the burning building. They crash through a wall into a bank, and it sets off the alarm. So the cops show up, and Frozone ends up freezing one of the cops solid, you know, in sheathed in ice. And you can see, while they're standing around talking, the cop is in the block of ice, or in the sheath of ice, and his eyes are darting back and forth. So clearly he's awake and he's conscious. How's he not dead? He can't breathe if he's sheathed in ice. So, yeah, I don't.
So you're saying he's not in perfect hibernation.
And correct. Yeah. So he would have to breathe, you would think. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. This happens a lot. I mean, I'll forgive, like, Captain America, for example. I'll forgive that because, as you say, he was in hibernation. I mean, mm-hmm. What's the deal with Robin? Is Robin in hibernation here, or?
No, Robin's on his way to the morgue.
Right.
And wait, this is what makes it even better. They throw this block of ice out in front of police headquarters in broad daylight. And Gordon and his men are sitting there looking out the window going, oh, look at that. There's Robin in a block of ice. Let's just call Batman and wait for him to show up. I mean, if he was really frozen in a block of ice and he could be dead, wouldn't you think maybe we should rush out there and see if we could help him out? And then this other group shows up that we're going to kidnap the frozen Robin in broad daylight in front of police headquarters. But why not? The police aren't doing anything.
Right. The two things that drove me absolutely nuts in this story, and you pointed out one of them already, was when, you know, as you say, you know, Robin's right outside the window. Gordon's looking at him, does nothing, you know, to a point where Robin almost gets abducted off the street by these guys. Then Batman
and these guys just happen to have the ice hooks with them, by the way.
Right.
Well, I always travel. You don't travel with them in your trunk?
I guess. And then Gordon just comes out, and, you know, Batman's basically, what the hell? You know, he even says, he says, you must have seen what was going on out here. And Gordon says, oh, sure. but I got a kick out of watching you in action. I'm thinking Batman should be like, I'm going to get a kick out of kicking you in the ass. You know, like, what the hell is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Commissioner Gordon is a voyeur.
I guess.
It's like he's playing Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window.
This is like the Batman 66 program, where it'd be like, oh, the bank's been robbed. Oh, this looks like a job for Batman, not the police. Get Batman on the hole. Someone robbed the grocery store. Get Batman.
I want to know, how big is the Gotham PD back during this time, and what exactly do they do? Like, what is the actual police force doing right now?
There's two guys that operate that searchlight on the roof. There's one guy that maintains the phone, and there's the commissioner.
I guess. Yeah.
And this Chief O'Hara.
Chief O'Hara.
The other one.
Who I don't think was sober once on that show.
Suddenly Claude Akins would make a great commissioner. Huh?
The other one is on the very next page at the top of the page. You know, they're loading Robin. Again, this is the funny thing. You've got two cops, you know, just two beat cops. I have to lift this big ass block of ice up all by themselves. Batman's not even bothering to help them. The commissioner's just standing by with his hands in his pockets. They load this block of ice into the back of the Batmobile. And then Gordon says the stupidest thing ever. He says, you know, it must be at least 50 degrees, but that ice block hasn't melted a single drop. We had this same thing happen in a Spider-Man comic not long ago. Remember the one where he fought Equinox? And I pointed it out then, and I bitched about it then. I'm going to bitch about it again now. 50 degrees is not hot, God damn it. 50 degrees is not that high above freezing. So, I mean, this being essentially New York, I know it's Gotham City, but, you know, it's essentially a stand-in for New York. Depending on what time of year this is, you got to factor in wind chill. It's not surprising at all it hasn't melted a drop. Now, if he said, God damn, it's 86 degrees out here, I can't believe this thing hasn't melted a drop, then okay, then I'm on board with that. But 50 degrees is not hot.
I find it amusing, transporting the big block of ice on the back of the Batmobile. It's like going with a convertible to pick up a couch.
I just like to see it like really sagging down in the back and maybe the front end lifting off the ground just a little bit, you know?
You know, I get he thinks it's a booby trap, but wouldn't you, let's get him to Star Labs and see what they or the hospital. Oh, no. I'll take him back to the Batcave and we can see what we can do.
And then he's using an acetylene torch. What if it had been just normal ice? He's going to burn a hole through Robin's thigh.
Well, we'd call him Stubby that.
Well, I mean, how does using a blowtorch on a block of ice cause the Batcave to form, like to drop in temperature and form ice crystals to a point where Batman almost freezes to death himself? How what is the science here?
Have you not seen
it happens? Rudolph the reason Red-Dose it happens is cause.
Say that again, Paul.
I said the reason it happens is cause.
I guess.
That's like when my kids were small. Why'd you do that? Because that's not an answer.
And Gordon was not just standing there. He was playing pocket pool.
Yeah, no, Gordon is a joke in this. But they don't give you any even pseudoscience explanation for how this ice block somehow, by trying to melt it, it then forms a block on Batman, and how they actually get Robin out of it. They don't give you any explanation. It's just, yeah, it happens.
Right.
So yes. You know, that is definitely a weakness in an otherwise weak story. It's a glaring weakness in an otherwise weak story.
Also, the Batcave is apparently not that secret anymore.
Oh yeah, you have the Courtney brothers there. Yeah, come on in, guys. Everybody, come on in.
That's a good point.
Set up the card table. We'll have a grand old time. Wouldn't it have been easier for the Flash to put on a bat costume and zip around rather than moving Batman? In fact, wouldn't that break his neck moving him that quick?
He's moving. Yeah, maybe. I was thinking, I'm trying to remember, was it in the Flash movie or in something where, like, if he moves somebody too fast, then they can't breathe or whatever it was, and he has to, like, do something to counteract that. It certainly can't be doing Batman any good to be bounced around by the Flash like a 2-year-old.
Shaking
at the speed of, you know, at a speed high enough that it appears there's three separate Batmans there.
Wait a minute. Is this the Batcave that Batman takes Robin to? Because he says he's taking
it to... Look at all the stalactites.
Yeah, I'm confused because he tells Gordon, he says, I'm taking it to my lab. He doesn't say Batcave. He says lab. And then, what's his name? Jerome comes in at some point. There's the flashback. And then Stingaree comes in. Stingaree says that he used the bug in the ice block to lead him to this secret lab. So if that's the case, then he just discovered the Batcave. He should know Batman's secret identity. That's never really addressed.
Right.
And then it says shortly... now we cut to Stingaree's den as if Stingaree had taken, you know, everybody to his place. So that's just kind of completely glossed over. Like, where the hell was this lab? Is this a lab in Gotham City or is this the Batcave?
See, I just assumed it was the Batcave, but you know what? Maybe it's just a lab he set up. Since he planned this whole thing.
That would be pretty convenient that he bothered to set up a lab just for the convenience of it not being the Batcave in this one particular story. You know what I mean? So either way, whether it is or whether it isn't, I have a qualm with this.
Yeah,
you'd be surprised the stuff Batman has set up around the city. You know, just in case.
Well, that's true, but I think that's more the modern day super ultra planner Batman that's 15 steps ahead. I, you know, for all the problems with this story, you know, for all the issues I have with it, one thing I absolutely love about it is that this is taking place in the era and demonstrating very well the version of Batman that I like best. Because I like Batman being, you know, well-trained as both a fighter and a detective and all of that. But I think it's gotten out of hand over the years that Batman is now the best at everything. First it was, you know, he's the world's greatest detective. And then when they were doing the adverts for Batman Year One, I remember one of the adverts was something like something to the effect of, he's the greatest fighter in the world or something. And I'm like, and now I think, doesn't DC now say he's like the smartest man in the world? Because I know that Mr. Terrific.
I think he's number two after Luthor.
Yeah, one or two. And I mean, come on. I mean, yeah. I like Batman. Don't get me wrong. But he can't be perfect at everything. He shouldn't be perfect at everything. I could see him having one, like maybe he's like the world's most well-trained fighter, or he's the world's greatest detective, or he's, you know, one of the world's smartest guys. But all three, I mean, people talk about Superman being boring because he's overpowered. Isn't that incredibly overpowering Batman? I mean, I think it just makes him boring. Yeah. If he's an unbeatable...
For some reason, it's okay when it's Batman.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I don't agree, but they treat it like it's okay when it's Batman.
Yeah.
Wait till he gets his phone booth that he could travel through time and he just goes back and puts whatever he's going to need.
Yeah. See, I like this. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't necessarily like him losing in a battle with some mort like Captain Stingaree, but at the same rate, it makes him more interesting when there's a little bit of, you know, there's the possibility of him being bested or momentarily set back or just injured, you know, by some guy like this. I don't know. I don't like the ultimate Batman, you know, the you know, where he's just unbeatable. So that didn't, on that level, that made this at least slightly more interesting than something, you know, more modern, I think, with Batman. But it was not a good story at the end of the day.
How great were those haircuts on the Courtney brothers? Aren't you glad we're not in the 70s anymore?
I do love, on the very last page of the story, though, that top panel. It looks like they're on the Tonight Show.
Yes.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Gordon looks like Johnny Carson.
Yeah. Yeah. You got Gordon and Carson. Then you've got the three, whatever the hell their name was, brothers sitting there. You've got Batman looking like he just came off doing like the opening for like a comedy routine or something. And then you've got Robin sitting there like Ed McMahon. It's great. Yeah, that one in the panel right beneath Batman at the top of the page, that very next one where he's wearing the Batman costume, but the cowl's pulled back. He looks like Shemp.
That's what I'm telling you. These haircuts were horrible. It's like, what was George Peppard in Brannigan, where he had it look like a bowl cut? Was it Brannigan? What was that detective show? Was it? It wasn't Brannigan.
Was it Banachek?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, horrible haircut.
Did Captain Stingaree not have his scar yet? Because eventually he has a scarred eye, which is why he's got the patch, the pirate patch. But I don't see that in this. Did that not happen yet?
This was my introduction to this guy.
I was looking for that. It's not at all visible. I'm flipping back and forth, and sorry, I'm not really seeing it in any of the panels. But you know, in the very last panel of the story, it's him in prison, and that right there, it's very obvious that it's not there. So I'm like, if he gained the scar later, then why is he wearing an eye patch now? Is the eye patch just an affectation, but then later he actually needs it?
I thought that was Lex Luthor sitting in the sun.
He looks like Luthor with an eye patch. Yeah, exactly.
Give him an eye patch. We need to distinguish him from Luthor.
Yeah, there you go. Well, thanks, Dave. This was a gem.
I'm glad.
Thanks for ruining Batman for us.
Wait till next month when we do one of the 40s books.
Ugh.
Okay. So, okay, Dave, give us your grades.
All right. Looking at the cover doesn't really do it for me. Captain Stingray he's like a dopey character. The scene is somewhat happens in the book, but it's not based in the reality of the story. I personally think it would have looked better if Batman was swinging a sword at Stingray as opposed to just holding it over his head. It's just a confusing scene. It looks like Stingray's trying to almost chop him out of the ice to rescue him. It's a confusing, non-dynamic cover in my view. I gave it a C. The interior art, I felt that splash page with the three Batman looked kind of bland. Zombie Robin he almost looks like he's flat, or he looks like he's from the Super Friends when he gets possessed. I mean, some of the art is decent. The triplets, as I said, the hair from the 70s. God, that's horrible. Stingray in the cell, again, he's a dead ringer for Luthor. The Flash looked good. I'd like to say something positive about the art. The Flash looked good. That's about it. The interior art, I gave a C+. The story, I beat to death. It's a weird, goofy story with a villain that could have been defeated by a bunch of Girl Scouts. It just made no sense, this whole story. And the story, I gave a solid D for an overall grade of a C-.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
You want to go?
Go ahead.
I think the cover is almost just average 1970s, you know, mid-1970s artwork. It's well drawn, I think, but it doesn't really scream at me, you know, by me. So you said a C. I'm thinking a C+. It's a little better than that, but not a lot. The interior art, I think we hit it on the head by calling it inconsistent. I think there's parts of it which are pretty decent. I think some of the fight choreography I like a lot. And there are a couple of individual panels that I like. However, there's definitely some bad shots. There's some questionable choices as far as angles go. I'm going to say a C+ on the art. I'm going to say a C on the art. I'm going to bring it down to a C because there's too much inconsistency. And the story, I think this is a bad story. So it's not totally incomprehensible, although it does have some gaping holes in it that you could drive a truck through. But, you know, you could read it and be somewhat entertained by it. So I won't give it an F because it's readable. But I'm gonna say a D on the story. I think it's bad, and overall, I'll give the book a C-. This is one of my less enjoyable Batman romps.
You know, the cover is weird because on first glance, it looks like, oh, this is a pretty cool cover. It's when you linger over it that you really start to kind of pick it apart and see the weirdness of it and kind of the, much like the interior, kind of the inconsistencies of it. It could have been a very dynamic cover. I think Dave makes a good point that Stingray is basically attacking the block of ice as opposed to attacking Batman. So what's the point of this cover? Are they supposed to be having a duel? What exactly is supposed to be happening here? Because Dave's right. It almost looks like he's trying to chop Batman free of the ice. Unless it's supposed to be where they were dueling and he missed or something. I don't know. It's very weird. And the Batman in the background just looked very strange as well. So yeah, it's a very odd cover. I'm going to say a C on the cover because it's just kind of there. I'm not sure what it's meant to be portraying. Interior art is all over the place. It's incredibly inconsistent. Some of it I really, really like, and then others of it I'm just like, ugh, this is the same. It's almost like it's not the same art team throughout. And there's some of it that I can't help but wonder if they're out and out swipes from other artists. And maybe that's lending into the inconsistency. I'm really not sure. Again, I agree with Dave. I think the opening splash is incredibly weak. I think it's meant to be very dynamic. Oh, there's three Batman? What's the story with that? But instead, it just looks odd and confusing. Like, okay, is this all supposed to be happening within the same frame? Or is this like vignettes all put together? You can't quite tell. And it's just odd. It's just very inconsistent. And I don't think the inking's particularly strong on that opening splash. I mean, I could just go through the whole book. I'm not going to, but it's just, it's like that through the whole book. It's up, it's down, it's all over the place artistically. So I think I'm going to give it actually a C- on the art. Cause I think there's actually more of it that's, inconsistently on the bad side rather than inconsistent on the good side. And then I can't believe you guys with the story rating. I think you're being far too generous. This is a flat F. I could not follow this thing at all. It's so stupid. There's vast leaps in logic. Again, realizing the whole Batcave thing. Is it the Batcave? Is it not the Batcave? It's just so weird. And I'm still, after having read this story twice and then kind of skimming it again as Dave was synopsizing it, I still don't understand the whole thing with the three brothers. When did they come in? Why are they involved? It makes no sense to me whatsoever. So I'm going a flat F on the story. I think it's dumb beyond dumb. Overall grade on this, I don't know. I think C minus is actually super generous. It's somewhere between a D plus and a C minus. It's pretty bad. I'm going to say a C minus only because there is some of the art I genuinely do like, despite the vast inconsistencies of it. So some of the artwork saves it just a bit from, being really seriously lowly graded, but it's not a good book.
Well, I'm glad I was able to bring this to spur some somewhat interesting discussion. I'm looking at this cover again now. You see the two little Batmen in the back? You move the one on the right about a few centimeters over, it's a whole new cover.
I'm sure it is.
Well, Paul, what have you brought to the table?
Okay, well, I brought Avengers number 221, which has a cover date of July of 1982. And it is yet another The Old Order Changeth Avengers issue. So the cover has a logo that says, "Who will be the newest members of the Avengers? Pick two. Answer inside." And they have 15 characters on the cover. Power Man, Spider-Man, Wolverine, Dazzler, Hawkeye, Rom, Invisible Girl, Daredevil, Ant-Man, Hulk, Doctor Strange, She-Hulk, Black Bolt, Spider-Woman, and Silver Surfer. So it immediately gets you kind of, curious, well, who are they going to pick? And you probably, at this point, there were still a lot of people who had never been Avengers. As of this point, Hawkeye had been an Avenger. Obviously, the Hulk had been an Avenger. And I think that's it on the cover. I don't think anybody else on here had been, because that's the Scott Lang Ant-Man. I don't think he had been an Avenger yet. So, you're sitting there and you're saying, "Ooh, who are they going to bring in here? This is going to be cool." I think it just, there were visions of, Rom and Black Bolt becoming Avengers, which would just be strange. Anyway, the story is titled New Blood. It is plotted by Jim Shooter and written by Dave Michelinie. Art is by Bob Hall with inks by Brett Blevins. Janice Chang did the lettering. And I can't even read who did the colors, so we'll just ignore that because I can't read it. So the story opens up. It's Wasp, Captain America, Iron Man and Thor all gathering in one of the Avengers meeting rooms, and they're discussing the fact that they need to change the old order, because things are getting a little stale and they're not performing as well as they normally would. So immediately they give opinions as to who, like the type of person they want, and each one of them wants somebody who kind of fits their own mold. Iron Man wants somebody who's got technical abilities. Thor wants somebody who's strong. Wasp wants some women in there. And what does Captain America want? Somebody who works well in a team. So they will part ways, saying they're going to give their choices at the next meeting. And then we cut to Thor sitting, and he's reading Time magazine with a picture of Spider-Man on the cover. And he's talking to Jarvis, and he decides that Spider-Man would be a good candidate. Meanwhile, Tony Stark and Steve Rogers talk, and they decide that Hawkeye would be a good candidate. The Wasp decides to have a party and invite all these women superheroes because one of them will fit because it doesn't matter if what their skill set is, as long as it's a woman. We have to have our diversity and inclusion based on the WASP's standards. So Thor goes to the park thinking he's going to find Spider-Man there. And there are some guys who had just ripped off, was it a truck or something? And they're escaping, and Spider-Man is confronting them. And while he does, Thor decides to just create a storm and rain and disable the villains that way. And Spider-Man's kind of annoyed that he's soaking wet because of it. And Thor says, you know, he wants to have a word with him. And they find a private place on the side of a building, and they're talking. And Thor explains to him that he thinks he'd be a good candidate for the Avengers. And he says he'll think about it, and he takes off. Iron Man and Captain America go and meet Hawkeye, who is the head of security at Cross Technologies. They explain to him that they think he would be a good candidate for the team, and initially he plays hard to get, but when they start to walk away, he immediately has second thoughts and lets them know he wants it. Then we cut to the Wasp's mansion, where she's having a little tea party for the women superheroes, and she's got the Invisible Woman and the Dazzler, Spider-Woman, Black Widow, and eventually She-Hulk joins the group. But then they get attacked by, what was his name again? I can't remember. Stankiewicz.
Mechano Marauder.
Yeah, but the Mechano Marauder is the vehicle he's using. But he's come after them before with different stuff, and he's almost the definition of Mort supervillain. And his whole plan here is that he's going after them because the Wasp is the weakest of the Avengers, so he figures he'll take her out to make a name for himself, and then he'll work from there. And then he shows up and he starts fighting them, and it's pretty well put together here, because as they're fighting, the women superheroes are almost indifferent about him. They're just kind of putting him down without even making an effort. And it's almost like you've never seen of them yawning while they're doing it. and as they're fighting him, some of them say, "Yeah, I have to leave." And they just get up and leave because he's so non-threatening. So eventually they take him out, you know, with relative ease. And then the various, or the members that we spoke of, present the people who they want on the team to Henry Gyrick, who is the government liaison to the Avengers. And you can see the paper. It's got Hawkeye and She-Hulk on there, and he's signing off on it. So then Hawkeye travels to the Avengers mansion, but while he's doing so, they get cut off by this pink Cadillac. He gets all pissed off. And it turns out that She-Hulk, so the two of them have a kind of an uncomfortable meeting initially, and the Wasp gives them each a kiss on the cheek and says that they're the Avengers, and that's how the issue ends. And we're told next we're gonna have the return of Egghead and the new Masters of Evil. So
is that no real Price?
Yes,
excellent.
No real threatening supervillain in this one. Never any point of any like serious suspense, but just kind of a fun character issue. The artwork is interesting in here. I think I'm going to give a lot of it to the inking, that it seems to be influenced by like what Bob Layton was doing and what Terry Austin was doing. I've said, you know, Bob Hall, I was never a big fan of his, but, you know, much like some other people, his artwork is consistently okay, but I think it rarely rose above that. But I do think Blevins' inks on here work well with his pencils. So for the most part, I enjoy the story for the character moments, and I enjoyed the artwork I just think it's nice and clean and well presented. Any thoughts?
Dave, had you read this before?
I had not.
You had not?
This is my first read through.
What'd you think of it?
It's not part of your reading project.
It's not part of my project, so I had to make an exception. I thought it was pretty good. It's not, a, you know, I wouldn't say like, oh my God, this is the greatest Avengers book ever. But it's a solid, fun little story. I didn't care for the art as much. I felt, and I don't know whether it's the inking or it's maybe it's the copy I'm looking at. It almost seemed like there was a smudge effect, you know, on some of the figures, particularly Captain America. Like on the splash page in particular, Cap almost looks like a color form that they slapped down there. And even again on page two, there's just something to me that looks off when it comes to Captain America. But the story, I thought it was fun. I liked the idea that, you know, they wanted to bring new blood, to quote Tony Stark, into the Avengers. And yet they wind up bringing back a guy who was in it already. Right? It's the same Hawkeye, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And She-Hulk, who seems like kind of a hothead. Actually, he's a bit of a hothead, too. So I don't know about, you know, team dynamic, if this was a good idea, not knowing what comes next.
I love this issue, but I'm going to be completely transparent that a lot of that is probably nostalgia talking. I bought this issue off the stands. I'm 100% certain this was the first issue of the Avengers I ever did buy off the stands with my own money. I don't think I could even tell you another issue of the Avengers that I'm absolutely certain I bought, you know, off the stands. But this one I did, primarily because this cover just spoke to me on the stands. It just, there's something about it that really, really grabbed me. I thought the art was great. I thought, you know, all these characters, I was like 14 when this came out, and really just getting into collecting comics. I was always a DC first boy, you know, all my life really, but especially at this time. But DC where I lived was so spotty that I was always on the hunt for, you know, anything else that looked like it might be interesting. And you give me a ton of heroes in one book, those are the kind of books I was drawn to. So this, with, you know, it's all these different heroes. And again, this is at a time I'm pretty sure when I didn't know who a lot of these people were, because I looked it up, and this issue is pretty concurrent with Marvel Superheroes Contest of Champions, which I credit for really informing a lot of my early knowledge of Marvel beyond, you know, the characters that every kid knows. You know, every kid knows Spider-Man and the Hulk, and maybe Captain America, you know, back then. But beyond that, there, you know, most of Marvel I was pretty unfamiliar with. I'm almost certain, just because the scene has stuck in my head all these years, the scene that always pops into my brain when I see this cover is the scene of Cap and Iron Man going to talk to Hawkeye, and Hawkeye, you know, reclining in the chair and all that, and having the little tiff with them. And then where he tears a page out of Playboy, you know, he's sitting there looking at Playboy, and that's, you know, he shoots the arrow with presumably the centerfold with the word yes written on it. That one page is just indelibly implanted in my mind. I'm pretty sure this was my initial exposure to Hawkeye. I can't completely swear to that, but I'm pretty darn sure. And so there's just so much of this that I fondly remember from childhood. I always really, really liked this issue. So much so that when I went to Tampa Bay Comic Con back in 2024, a couple of years ago, I took a couple of books for Bob Hall to sign. He was appearing there, and this was one of the books. And what's funny is first thing he did was point out that he did not do the cover, which I knew that, you know, going into it, that he didn't do the cover, that he just did the interiors. I love this cover. I wish he had been, even though he didn't do the cover, I wish he had been selling, you know, like a lot of the artists will sell like lithograph prints of, you know, famous, you know, the covers of famous books that they did and everything. I really wish he'd had one, but of course it's not his art, so he wasn't selling one, but I just love this cover. But even though I'd really be hard pressed to tell you, you know, other books that he had done, you know, he's not one of my favorite artists or anything like that. I'm impressed with the art in this, but I think Paul's hit upon something. I think a lot of the art in this, a lot of the reason I like the art so much is Brett Breeding's inks. I think it's what Breeding's doing with the inks in a lot of this story that really makes it work for me, especially with the Meccano Marauders outfit, you know, his initial you know, tank-like outfits, really cool, especially, damn, pages aren't numbered, but when he smashes through the window and grabs the Dazzler, that second panel of him standing there, just the Zipitone shading on that mechanical monster is really sharp. I mean, it's very Bob Layton, Iron Man-like, and I love that. But then later, after his outer outfit, you know, his tank-like outfit gets damaged and he switches to basically Iron Man mode, that one, even though it's big and clunky and weird looking, is really cool. I really like that outfit. And again, I like some of the shading and effects that are done on that with the inking and the coloring. So yeah, I think, you know, this is a nice combination of all the artistry just really coming together nicely. You know, the you know, Bob Hall's doing some, you know, good breakdowns for, you know, the pencil stuff. Breeding is just bringing it up a whole nother level with the inking. And then the colors by Christy, is it Scheel? I guess is the name. I don't recognize that name. But the colors are fantastic in this as well and really lend into the artistry on this. So I've always liked the art in this. I've always thought this was one of the better looking issues of the Avengers, especially from this particular era. And I like the story. I still think after all these years, I still think the story is good. I still think it's a lot of fun. And I can't remember if I noticed this on a conscious level as a kid, but I definitely noticed it now. I think one of the things that really spoke to me about this as a kid, again, whether I realized it consciously or not, is that this is one of those stories that at this time I feel was kind of rare, but one of the kind of stories that I started to focus on more over the years as becoming kind of my favorites is when it's not your stereotypical, oh, we just got to go fight the bad guy. This is a character study. I mean, yes, there is a bad guy. The bad guy's a mort and he's easily defeated. He's not the point of the story. He's not like what, he's not the mission. The mission here is just basically it's a recruitment drive and it's an opportunity to showcase characters and have the characters talk, have them interact, get in their heads a little bit. And I love that. I love when comics do stuff like that, when they're not afraid to slow down and just be soap opera-y, if you know what I mean. And I like that stuff. You know, it doesn't bother me at all, as long as it's well done. It doesn't bother me at all when we get just an issue that's just the characters doing care, you know, normal people stuff to a certain degree. I really like that. I like getting to know these characters because especially when you sit down and you may binge a run of something, you know, it gets boring after a while when there's never any downtime, when it's bad, you know, it's okay, on to the next bad guy, on to the next threat. You know, the world's in danger this issue, the world's in danger next issue. Next issue, Luther's on the loose again. Next issue, it's giant monsters attacking the city. And you never get a chance. Like, who are these people? What do they do in their downtime? They're not getting any downtime. So when they do in an issue like this, I really, really enjoy it. I think it's a really nice character study. And I this has always been one of my favorite issues. I was so happy when I saw that this was what Paul chose, because I could gush about this all day. I think it's just a great issue. It didn't occur to me until Paul mentioned it in his synopsis, and it triggered a memory. So She-Hulk is driving a pink Cadillac. I don't know if either of you guys remember, but back in the 90s, Hardee's, the hamburger chain, they had a promotion, and their kids meal, whatever they call it, you know, their version of a Happy Meal. The boxes were all Marvel themed, and they came with a toy, and each of the toys was a Marvel superhero in a vehicle, and She-Hulk is in a pink Cadillac. And I had that toy as a kid, and I thought, this is the weirdest thing ever. Why is She-Hulk in a pink Cadillac? Here she is in a pink Cadillac. So I think that's cool. It actually did tie into something that I'd completely forgotten. I thought that was really kind of neat.
Did she work for Avon on the side?
Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, I looked it up just to make sure that my memory was correct. And sure enough, I'm seeing there's a lot. I don't know how many were in the set, but there's a lot on eBay right now. It says Hardee's 1990 Marvel Superheroes. It says complete set of four, and it was the Hulk driving a bulldozer, Cap on this weird like sled. It actually looks a lot like the sled thing he flies in the very beginning of the Captain America and the Avengers video game, if you remember that. She-Hulk in the pink Cadillac, and then I can't tell who this other guy is. It kind of looks like it's either Magneto or Spider-Man. I can't quite tell, and it's probably Spider-Man because he's in an eight-wheeled vehicle. So that's probably Spider-Man, but I can't quite make out. The picture's not very good. But, yeah, I just thought that was really cool.
You know what I liked? I liked the way Thor was portrayed, because I felt it kind of almost went against some of the stereotype from what I remember about Thor. I liked that he sought Jarvis's counsel.
Yeah.
You know, like, let me ask the regular – and, like, he – listen to what he had to say. I also like the meetup between him and Spider-Man, that it didn't devolve into, you know, throwing fists at each other like so often it does.
I just like the fact of, I don't know, there's something, I'm tempted to use the word magical. There's something magical about seeing Thor this way. I completely agree with you. You know, the shot of him that should be completely ridiculous, of Thor sitting there reading Time magazine. It should be ridiculous, but it's kind of cute and it's kind of charming. And then, yeah, I agree with you. Thor is such a weird choice to go recruit Spider-Man, but somehow it really works. And I like the fact that they're not two characters that you even really think about knowing each other or being chummy with each other. Yet they are, and I like that. I think that's pretty neat. I've always thought it was kind of a shame that Spider-Man says he'll think about it, but then that's it. We don't ever get anything more on that. I always, as a kid, I remember being one of those guys that was always like, why doesn't Spider-Man join the Avengers? Maybe it would help his image, you know, maybe it would help get JJ off his back kind of thing, you know, if he gained a little
Fred.
Credit, or, you know, what's the word? A little, I can't think of it, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's like street cred.
Legitimacy, legitimacy, yeah.
Is the chauffeur supposed to be Stan Lee?
Oh, is he?
To me, it looks like Stan Lee.
For years, they had her show for being in the villain Whirlwind, and they didn't realize it.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I don't know if he's supposed to be Stan Lee, but I caught, again, the damn pages aren't numbered, but on the page where Hawkeye is leaving the building, he gets in the cab, and then he gets cut off by She-Hulk. He's looking at Time Magazine, which is basically the cover of this book, but just with Time instead of Avengers on the cover. But then the very next panel where he's thinking to himself, it'll be tough holding down two jobs, is showing the back cover. And I'm pretty sure that's supposed to be Jim Shooter on that back cover. It looks like, I don't know if Shooter ever smoked, because this guy's smoking a cigarette, but that sure does look like Jim Shooter on the back. And Shooter did, at one point, he was voted, most eligible bachelor by, I think it was Playgirl. Something like that. I don't know if that predates this or if that was after this, but I'm pretty sure that's supposed to be him. And I almost wonder if that's a nod to the whole Playgirl thing. Did you notice who signed
yes.
the executive order?
I was going to go there next.
Yeah.
I love
Ronald my gosh, Reagan. I just noticed something. I don't think I've ever noticed this before. Look at the pictures on Bonzo. Reagan's desk.
Bonzo.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even notice that. That's funny.
I love.
You do see the White House, and you know you get him from behind, and just for people who may not know what we're talking about. It's the president at the time this issue came out. I like the fact that they make it clear that that's who it is, but they don't overstate. You know, they don't overdo it. So
right.
when you're reading this now, you know, whatever, 40 years later, 44 years later, you're not sitting there saying, oh, you know, that dates it so much, because right. they don't really, it's not in your face.
Well, you know, it was almost, there was a point in time, and I think I read this, or someone took a class about film, where they were saying in, you know, earlier movies, like through the 40s, 50s, you never saw the president. Like, you'd see him from behind, or you'd see in shadow. Like, they never wanted to show you the face of the president.
Right.
And this is what that kind of reminds me of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the president signing the order, basically granting Hawkeye and She-Hulk admission to the Avengers, and it's dated April 8th. 1992. This was 4 days before my 14th birthday.
1982.
Is it? Oh, you're right. It's 82. That's right. Yeah. God, that was long.
Instead of being 4 days before your 24th birthday.
Right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, 82, not 92.
You're making yourself younger. You can't fool us.
No, I misspoke. It's 82. Yeah.
I had mentioned that there was a lot of character pieces in this, and then you kind of took that further. And I compare this to more modern stuff. And, you know, Brian Michael Bendis was like the master of the character pieces in his books. But I did feel that sometimes he would like overdo it, because you mm-hmm. had issues where, you know, they're decompressed. So you're not really getting much story at all. And it's all just character and done. This had a lot going on. This had a lot of character pieces, but the plot was moving forward, where you had, you know, they had a goal, find the new members of the team, and then, you know, you got the thought process with it, and then you even had the battle with, you know, with the lame villain. So there was much more thought to this and much more heft than some later character pieces. And I don't mean to badmouth Brian Michael Bendis on that, because he did do a really good job a lot on his dialogue and character pieces. But again, because it came in a decompressed era, it fell a little bit more flat than this did to me. this really, you know, did it the right way as far as I was concerned.
Well, this, I mean, granted, this is, you know, looking back at it as opposed to taking it in the era or, you know, taking it at the time it came out. But looking back on, I mean, this was just such a magical time at Marvel, you know. It was like the perfect time because you had, you know, Shooter was running the company. You had so many superstars, you know, at Marvel at the time. I mean, you've got Dave Michelinie as the writer on this. Just a great time. You've got just the perfect mix of the Avengers operating at this time and bringing in, you know, some good new characters. And then, you know, some of the guest stars in this, you know, just it's a nice time capsule of this moment of Marvel Comics, which was, you know, a great time. I mean, it's my personal favorite, but of course, a lot of that's prejudice because, you know, this was when I was getting into Marvel, you know, and I think you're always kind of, you know, it's always your first love is, you know, that the era you got into it, you know, the era you discovered it. And this is definitely when I was getting into it. But yeah, just it brings the warm fuzzies to me. I really, really enjoyed this. It was fun looking back on it.
All right. So unless you have anything else to add, I think we can rate this.
Okay.
All right. See, now the cover is interesting to me because I don't think that anybody is drawn so exceptionally well that I think, oh, that's beautiful the way they're drawn. But the layout and the whole idea of it is just very, very compelling. And it's all drawn fine. Again, you know, there's nothing about it that I think is bad. And again, you know, as I mentioned when I started talking about it, I think it just gets your imagination going. Oh, what if this one is an Avenger? What if that one is an Avenger? So I'm going to give it a B+ because I do feel the characters could have been drawn slightly better, but I just think it's such a great concept that I'm going to give it that high of a rating. The interior art, I'm not the biggest Bob Hall fan, and I think I've said that every time I've reviewed a book that Bob Hall drew, but I really like the art here. I think the inking brings it up a level. I think the layouts are fine, and I think the inking brings it up. I think I'm seeing influence here by George Perez, by, again, Bob Layton, by Terry Austin, by John Byrne. I think I'm seeing a lot of influence here where they were trying to create images not dissimilar from the way that they would draw them.
I agree with you because I definitely think that Hall's cap here is influenced by Mike Zeck's cap.
I
see that a lot.
And sometimes when they're trying too hard to ape another artist, it falls flat. I'm thinking of I'm trying to remember, like, one of the Thing Hulk books that we did where Herb Trimpe was trying to do like somebody else's look, it just didn't work at all. This, I feel like it works. I'm going to give this also a solid B to B plus on the artwork. I think it really, you know, was good for me. And the story is an A. I think this story just, again, it's a character piece done right. So overall, I'm going to give the book an A-.
Would you like me to go next?
I can be short and sweet on this one. I don't care if it's nostalgia talking. I'm going A+ across the board. I love this issue. I absolutely adore it. So yeah, that it's an easy one for me.
I was just giving you the opportunity to sing its praises, my friend. The cover is my favorite aspect of the book. I think it's a cool concept. I love that they use a blank box for the Invisible Girl.
Yeah.
I like they include characters that aren't even under consideration within the story. And I love it because it's a ripoff of the magazines at the time. I remember covers like this where, who will be next on the Supreme Court or some crazy stuff? And they just have a bunch of, you know, boxes just like this. I haven't thought about Time magazine in years. Pick 2, the answer will be inside. Buy it to find out. Fantastic. I think all the characters look fine. I'd say if you're going to pick one to nitpick, it's Doctor Strange. Other than that, I think the rest are fine. It's a fun cover. And it's in the story because it's just like Time Magazine in the book. So I gave the cover a solid A. I wasn't so high on the interior art. Like I said, to me, some of the panels seem to be kind of smudged. I wasn't thrilled with some of the color choices, particularly the flashback scenes in that almost monochrome type of, coloring. I wasn't a fan of that. I did think Janet looked great on page 11. I think the chauffeur looked like Stan Lee. And my biggest pick on the interior art was that car looks nothing like a Cadillac of any kind that they've ever made. The story I thought was really good. It was a fun concept. Wasp seems to be ahead of the times in the DEI agenda. Like I said, Thor was fantastic. Hey, are you allowed to read porn at work? I know I'm not. So good on Hawkeye. And the inclusion of President Reagan. I gave the story an overall B+. For a total grade on the book of a solid B.
Awesome. Paul, do you remember, you've read ROM, right?
Yes.
Do you remember if or when he stopped being a fugitive? Because remember during...
Not a fugitive, no.
At least during the earliest issues of his series, he was a fugitive. He was wanted because, to human perception, when he banished dire wraiths to limbo,
they thought he was killing them.
They thought he was killing people, so he was a fugitive. So it's odd that he's included in the potential list of Avengers here. And that's not just on the cover of the book, that's in story, because again, the Time Magazine cover, he is one of the people that's listed. So that's kind of an odd one. Thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking that the...
could have been.
He was generally wanted.
Right.
But I'm thinking that the cover was conceived independent of the story, and then they just decided to include it in the story.
Right.
Like, I don't think they gave thought to, well, if it was really Time Magazine, who would be on the cover?
Well, this is pretty representative of, all the titles that were out at the time, really, that weren't licensed titles like Star Wars or something like that. So, yeah.
Well, ROM was a licensed title, but that's besides
the point. But it took place in the Marvel Universe, though. Unlike, they wouldn't have, C-3PO on this cover because that didn't take place. It was a Marvel book, but it didn't take place in the world.
G.I. Joe.
But, eventually they lost the license to ROM and they didn't really reprint anything. But for some reason, this cover, and it's even mentioned on their wiki page, that this cover somehow escaped that banishment from Marvel, that they've reprinted it on several occasions and they haven't had to like edit him out or anything.
They're lucky, because when they did that with Spider-Man, there's an issue of the Transformers that had the black suited Spider-Man in it. It's the only issue of the Transformers I own, for that reason. When they were doing collections, they couldn't reprint that issue because it had Spider-Man in it. Mm-hmm. So I remember somebody, a friend of mine that was really into Transformers, I remember him showing me a collection he had, one of those trade reprintings. And when it got to that particular issue, it was just a prose recap of the story. They weren't allowed to reprint any of it.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, well, I'm getting tired, so I'm going to say good night, everybody. It's been a pleasure presenting these two books to you in our fedoras.
That was fun. Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night. Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.